everyone. There's only so much time in the day. That's why we edited this Vermont Edition podcast for brevity. I know you'll thank us.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Happy Halloween. We are hard-nosed journalists here at Vermont Edition, but even we like to take a moment for some levity. Or maybe not so much levity, since we're aiming for spine-tingling. But, you know, we all need to take a little break from the tough stuff to gather together for a ghost story or two. Author Joe Citro has long been the chronicler of Vermont's ghosts and has been referred to as the Bard of the Bizarre. Several years ago, Joe wrote a commentary for VPR in which he revealed Vermonters' first ghost hunter.
So far, the outstanding candidate is Ira Allen, brother of Ethan and father of the University of Vermont. In his autobiography, Ira talks about some friends he met in the early 1770s, a mother with two lovely daughters. He writes, "They used to amuse me by telling frightful stories of ghosts and apparitions, amongst which there were many stories about an old woman without a head." Ira writes, "One evening I challenged the old woman without a head and all the ghosts to meet me at any time and place they chose." The very next day, some of Ira's hogs escaped. As darkness fell, he went looking for them along a snowy footpath leading deep into the woods. A little farther along, he says, "To my no small surprise, at about 8 rods distance, I saw the perfect appearance of a woman without a head, her shoulders, waist, arms akimbo, her hands on her hips. Her clothes and feet below were in perfect shape." With that, he raised his cane and advanced. He says, "I came within about 30 yards before I discovered the cause." He found that a tree had been broken off by the wind, leaving a human-sized stump. Some of its bark had fallen away, creating the illusion of a white dress. Above that, a dappled pattern, the work of woodcocks, completed the upper torso. "The night made the darker areas invisible," Ira wrote, "forming the size and figure of a headless woman." To satisfy himself, he went back to the original spot. From there, the headless woman was visible again. And then Ira Allen writes a line that perhaps reveals the source of a lot of ghost stories. He wrote, "Had I been frightened and run away, I might, like others, have believed in the spectral appearances."
That's VPR commentator and Vermont's Ghost Master General, Joe Citro. And if he's Ghost Master General, Thea Lewis is Queen of Halloween. She's also the creator of Queen City Ghost Walk and the author of several books. And she's in the studio with us now. Thea, it's nice to have you here.
It's great to be here.
And Tim Simard is happy to take you on a walk if you want to go to some spooky places. He's the author of Haunted Hikes of Vermont. Tim, it's nice to see you in the studio today.
Oh, thank you. Good afternoon.
So, you know, Joe Citro's story sort of ends like, wah, wah, not really a ghost. What do you think? Are there ghosts? Are there things that are worth maybe running away from so we don't know the truth because it's fun, Thea?
I'd say most definitely. And I think, you know, as you mentioned, we've got some tough times going on. And so we're all embracing the horror of things that are unknown a little bit more than we normally would.
Oh, that's a sad commentary on the world. Well, it's better to embrace the horror of the unknown than the horror of reality.
Well, studies have shown that during tough times, like during the last economic crash, people begin to look toward things that frighten them a little bit more, that sort of visceral feeling. You know, the spine tingling stuff. If you look at 2008 and 2009 and then see the proliferation of ghost shows on TV, you'll see an example of that.
Why do you think that is? Is it that we can have a little bit of controlled fear and you know that when you get off the Queen City Ghost Walk, it's over, or when you put that book down, it's over? I mean, why would people be searching out more adrenaline?
I think that's absolutely true. It's a controlled fear, and it's something that is also a big distraction. Yeah, from every day, from the very real sort of worries of everyday life.
Tim, what do you think?
I think that's actually an interesting thought. I mean, I always think about if you're in your trying times and you need to take a break, you know, getting out into the woods, taking a hike, you know, clearing your head in Mother Nature, is maybe the one of the better ways to kind of de-stress.
Yeah, but although, I never want to hike again now that I've read your book. Because,
that's true.
Yeah.
Depends on the hike you're on, I suppose. I mean, then you could have all sorts of other problems that you didn't anticipate, I'm sure.
Like ghosts.
Right, exactly. Like something jumping out at you in the woods. Yeah.
All right, well, let's just get right to it. So, Tim, tell us first about maybe one spot, one hike that you really think is spine-tingling and worth going on.
Well, I will speak for myself and say that they're all spine-tingling and worth going on.
Of course.
The one where I actually had my own unexplained incident happened actually down at Glastonbury, which is in Bennington County, Glastonbury Mountain.
And a famous, I mean, legendary haunted mountain.
Yeah, definitely. And Joe Citro has actually done a lot in that, making that air part of the state famous because there were so many disappearances in the 40s and 50s, unexplained disappearances of hikers that, he put two and two together and was like, well, maybe there's some kind of like vortex or something that's like scooping up these people and putting them, elsewhere. There's just a lot of unexplained issues that have happened there. But so I decided to explore that. I'd never actually hiked that part of the Long Trail before. It's really one of the more inaccessible spots in the state. You have to do a lot of walking, more than just a mile. So one day around this time of year, a couple of years ago, I decided to do a big loop up the Long Trail north and down the West Ridge Trail. Turns out it was 26 miles, so it was like a marathon in one day, which I do not recommend. my legs were very sore at the end of that one. But
might have been hallucinating.
I hope not, but it's entirely possible. I only saw two people the whole day, and I think they were real. But at one point, as I was heading off the summit of Glastonbury, I was going down through this notch before I had to climb up the West Ridge, and I heard what I thought was a train sound, like an actual like train through the woods. Like it sounded closer than it should have been because there were no train tracks around. And I'd actually heard from my wife's family members that they'd actually experienced the same thing while camping up there hunting. And there's no train. There used to be a train that went through there to log and clear the land back 150 years ago. But there was no way I could have heard a train whistle at that spot in the mountains. There was one. There is a train that goes from Manchester through Arlington, like a scenic rail. But where I was blocked by sound and wind, there's no way I would have heard it. But it was very apparent that it sounded like a train whistle. And I didn't really think too much of it till I got back. And I was like, okay, that was weird. At the moment, I was like, but... Yeah, later.
So how do you, as somebody who writes about spooky places, who follows stories, who probably gets stories from a lot of people as well, when you have an unexplained experience yourself, I mean, just the fact of writing about spooky things or leading ghost walks doesn't mean you have to necessarily believe in the paranormal. So how do you then work it out in your head?
Yeah, I'm pretty skeptical about a lot of this stuff. I mean, a lot of things you can debunk. I remember hearing noises in the attic when I used to live at St. Michael's College, thinking there was somebody up in the attic. It was probably just a large squirrel, But, what do I think when I experience something that's unexplained? I try to rationalize it in my head, saying, oh, maybe it was the wind, maybe it was that. But at the end of the day, you just kind of have to sit back and be like, I don't know, and just kind of go with it and be okay with that.
Thea, same for you?
No, not at all. I grew up in a family that you could call a little ghosty. That's the way I describe them. I had a grandmother and aunts who used to have a sort of precognition. One aunt in particular, it was a little spooky when I was a kid. If there was a family member or a close friend who passed away, she always knew ahead of time because she would see this spectral figure. It wasn't something that I really thought of as a career until I visited Salem, Massachusetts, and I went on my first ghost tour. And on the way back home, I could not get the name Queen City Ghost Walk out of my head. It was back in 2001. I'm all about it, and I'm all about debunking ghosts too. I mean, there are lots of stories, urban legends that you hear over and over again, and you can find them regionally all across the country and even outside the United States. But a good ghost story is hard to top. And if you feel like you see an apparition, it's an experience you just don't forget.
So for you, is it an attraction to the ideas or do you share that precognition? Is that a hereditary thing in your family?
I have a little bit of intuition. My husband likes to say I cast a spell on him and he fell in love with me. But, I do tarot readings. I like to dabble in a sort of supernatural stuff. But I do feel like I've seen ghosts, and my daughter has, and my granddaughter. So it's something that kind of goes down the line of the family. And I know that everybody you know, and you should, with many things, take things with a grain of salt. But for me, it's a way of life now.
Here's one of the stories that we have been hearing from people. Sarah Sanfilippo, who's the director of library resources at Southern Vermont College in Bennington, wrote to us to say that she's actually been collecting student stories of ghosts at the school, and we have a link to all of them. But here's one of the stories. It's written by someone named Matthew. One Saturday evening, just after the semester started, several friends and I decided to head up to the Everett Mansion. We headed up through the field and entered the grounds of the mansion where the business office is. We noticed that despite it being after midnight and a Saturday, the light in the office was on and the windows open. What was most odd was the fact that 1920s jazz music could be heard coming from the office. We stood in the lawn underneath the open window for a few minutes until one of my friends yelled up in a loud voice something to the effect of, "Who's up there?" Almost immediately, the music switched off and the lights went out. Then suddenly, the windows slammed shut. We quickly raced to the opposite of the building where the parking lot is. No one exited the building in the 30 minutes we stood there waiting. So one spooky story there. I'd love to hear more. Listeners, please share them with us. You can write them in that really sort of lovely literary way, or just call and tell us, 800-639-2211. And while we're on a roll, let's go to William Alexander, who teaches at Vermont College of Fine Arts and is the author most recently of A Properly Unhaunted Place. William Alexander, it's nice to have you on the line with us.
Hello, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, speaking of colleges, Vermont College of Fine Arts, I've actually done a ghost story there. You have some ghosts at the college. You want to tell us about Anna?
We do indeed. I'm actually calling from the fourth floor of College Hall, which is where Anna is supposed to haunt. She died more than 100 years ago, apparently in a love triangle. She was murdered by the other woman named Mildred. Both of them were vying for a dashing young Canadian named Jack.
I mean, who wouldn't?
I mean, really. His name was Jack. Of course. And Mildred also is the subject of some ghost stories. Supposedly, she haunts the asylum that she was later committed to. She was one of the very first successful uses of the innocent for reasons of insanity defense.
Hmm.
Were in Mildred's trial, but there are two ghosts really in College Hall, and we know about Anna, and we've named our cafe after Anna, and she tends to haunt the fourth floor, and she is not at all malevolent. She's a pretty benign presence by all accounts, but something also haunts the basement, and no one is very happy with the basement haunting. Whoever it is tends to lock themselves into the women's bathroom fairly often. The door is locked and no one's there. And it's unclear whether or not that is Mildred, and the two of them continue to vie for now possession of the college from opposite ends, or whether that's some other unnamed unhappy thing. But those are... We have at least those two.
At least those two, yes. It wasn't the college at one time. The green out in front of the college was used as, I think, a field hospital in one of the wars, right? So there could also be other hauntings?
The Civil War, yes. Yeah. It was a field hospital during the Civil War.
So I want to ask you about your book, though, too, because here we are talking about ghost stories and this sort of American culture around ghosts. And your latest book, A Properly Unhaunted Place, sort of twists that or takes that idea and looks at it from a different lens and a different cultural lens. Will you tell us a little bit about sort of the culture of ghosts and how you're writing about them?
Sure, absolutely. Something had been bugging me for a while about our relationship to history. The worst thing about how we teach history in the United States is we teach it as though it's over. And a haunting is the history of the place that is still happening, that never stopped happening. And a friend of mine years ago, Ryo Saito, she taught Japanese at the college where I was teaching at the time. And we were getting coffee between classes, and she just said, "Your ghost stories are strange. They're strange. They're weird. Americans have the weirdest ghost stories." And I asked her why. She said, "The goal of every horror movie, every ghost story that we try to tell in the United States is to make the ghost completely go away. The monster has to be killed. The ghost has to be gone. If it's a nice ghost, we help it find rest, so it'll leave. And if it's something nastier, we banish it or exorcise it or cast it out or whatever we do. But no matter what, the goal is always the same. Find a ghost, the ghost must go. The ghost has to leave. And that's not how ghost stories are told and treated necessarily elsewhere in the world, that you cannot completely banish the history of a place. You can't unhaunt a place. So I flipped it. I flipped the script. It's set in the United States-ish, my book, but it's a story, and it's a kid's book. It's for middle grade, which says 8 to 12-year-olds on the back of the cover. The world is known to be haunted, completely haunted, and it's set in a town with no ghosts, and no one knows why. There's one place, as far as anybody knows, one place in the entire world that is not haunted. And that is the scary thing. That's the unsettling thing, that whatever happened in that place is silence.
Thea Lewis, I see you nodding out of the corner of my eye. Does that idea appeal to you?
It does appeal to me, because after years of living in a succession of places that I believe to be pretty haunted, I moved into a 1960s raised ranch, and the first thing I thought was, wow, this seems pretty clean. I'm disappointed.
Oh, perfect.
William Alexander, for you, has writing this book and thinking about our cultural beliefs and our cultural stories changed how you think about haunting stories and haunted places?
It has. Or it's, at the very least, it's clarified things that were itching at the back of my brain that bothered me that I wasn't really sure how I felt about.
Oh, I can't wait to read the book. It's called A Properly Unhaunted Place. William Alexander teaches at Vermont College of Fine Arts as well. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. Loved being here.
All right. We're talking about ghost stories. We're talking about haunted places. More to come with Thea and Tim. And from you, we want to hear your stories. Dan in Westminster says, it's a good time to hike up Bald Mountain, starting from the Townsend State Forest parking lot. Friday will be the 90th anniversary of when hideous alien crustaceans were washed down the brook next to that trail during the flood of 1927. At least, that's according to H.G. Lovecraft in his weird tale, The Whisperer in Darkness. Lovecraft describes the terrain as horrific hills. It's really just a pleasant 3.4-mile hike with a nice view of Stratton Mountain, but if you read the story first or watch the 2011 movie, you can get a little creeped out. I do wish that the brook would get officially renamed Whisperer Brook. We are embracing the spirit of the day today, literally, and we're talking about haunted Vermont. We've got two experts with us for this segment, and we're also hearing from others around the state. Thea Lewis is the creator of Queen City Ghost Walk and the author of Haunted Burlington and Ghosts and Legends of Lake Champlain. Tim Simard is the author of Haunted Hikes of Vermont. Anne in East Wallingford says, my true story occurred 20 years ago. My husband and I were looking for a rental in the Killington area, and we went to see a house in Pittsfield. Touring the impressive old farmhouse, I felt a chilling draft blow in around my ankles. Unable to find the source of the draft, I wondered why it was so chilly on this late summer day and worried about heating the old house. Once outside in the warmth of the sun, our thoughts turned to the location, perched just above the Clear River Tavern. We went into the tavern, and as I sat, I watched my husband jerk backwards and fall in his chair. Eyes open wide, he spun around to look behind him with a shocked, pale look on his face. Someone just pushed me down in the chair, he exclaimed incredulously. I saw no one, but I did see him crash into the chair. He was so disturbed, he immediately asked the bartender if there had been signs of a ghost, and we began to hear tales of banging pots and crashes in the kitchen when no one was in there, the volume turning up and down on the stereo system, and other tales. Needless to say, we did not rent the house. And Douglas from Rutland says, Wilson Castle in Proctor is extremely active with spirits and the paranormal. The castle is open for tours, and many guests experience hearing footsteps on the closed third floor, as well as a lady often seen peering out a window in an old black dress. We've collected three photos that cannot be explained. A couple times a year, we host the South Glens Fall Paranormal Society to do an investigation with the public. Anyone who's ever been never leaves disappointed in what they experience. Thea Lewis, I want you to give us a story here of something that, you know, you think is particularly good for today as we share these stories.
Well, As you've already said, I walk around the city of Burlington and other spots close by, treating people to ghost stories with Queen City Ghost Walk. But one of my favorite stories is a story about a ghost investigation that I participated in at the Richmond Victorian Inn. I was there with my friends, the Vermont Spirits Detective Agency. They call themselves the Private Eye for those who've died. And we were having a great time with the hosts at the inn. And after it got to be quite late, probably midnight, 1 o'clock, we all went up to the Pansy Room. Now, the Pansy Room had something very special going on, a rocking chair that was said to rock all by itself. So Matt, the leader of the investigation team, was setting up the equipment, and I was chatting with a few guests that we had on the investigation. Now, as I was talking and talking and talking, because I'm a chatty person, I was trying to figure out where would I sit during this investigation, because that's critical. You want to be comfortable. You don't want to be making any additional noises. You want to let the ghosts shine through. So I walked around this beautifully made bed, and I thought, maybe I'll sit on the edge of the bed. And then I said, no, because it's so pretty. I don't want to mess it up in this great B&B. So I decided I would go sit on the floor. Well, just as we were getting ready to get going, Matt discovered a technical issue. And he said, well, we've got to go ahead and I'm going to start again. Just wait for me and I'll let you know when we're starting. So I actually started talking about some time that Matt and the team and I had spent at Wilson Castle. It was about 22 degrees outside when we were at Wilson Castle and about 22 degrees inside because there was no heating or ventilation system.
Wilson Castle, which we just got that email about.
Yeah. So I was talking to the guests on this investigation in the Pansy Room and going on and on. And finally, I said it was the coldest ghost investigation. And before I could say ever, Matt jumped in and said, all right, we're all set. So we spent a great time there. We all spent the night at the Richmond Victorian Inn, but we didn't get any concrete evidence while we were there. Kind of disappointing. A few weeks later, Matt called me after dinner time, and he asked if he could come over with his computer because he'd had a chance to go through all of the materials he'd collected during the investigation. He sat down in my living room, and we're listening to the recording, and I identify the time that I'm trying to figure out where I'm going to sit by my conversation, and all of a sudden he stops and he says, "Now listen closely," and he turns up the volume, and we hear a voice say, "Share my bed." A female voice. Now, she sounded lovely. Her voice came up with a little bit of static, a little bit, the way I describe the sound around it was bubbly, kind of like a scuba diver bubble. So that was fine. But there was another ghost. There I was on the recording talking about Wilson Castle and what a terribly cold night it was. And when I got to the point where I said, it was the coldest ghost investigation, and Matt's about to say, okay, we're ready to go, a male voice, very put out, says sarcastically, ever.
Ooh.
Like, broad, couldn't you ever shut up, you know? That was creepy. We kept playing it over and over again, you know, the me talking and then the ever, until my husband and our niece who lived with us came out of their respective bedrooms and said, that is just the creepiest thing I've ever heard.
So do you wish you had sat on the bed? Was that ghost speaking to you or to the other ghost in the room?
You know, I'm not sure. I think that I'm too proper and polite to look. I know what goes into a properly made frilly bed, and I just didn't want to mess it up. I didn't know who would be staying in that room. I have to tell you, I stayed right next door to the Pansy Room all night long, and I might have slept with the light on if I'd known the response I got from all of my chattiness.
Ooh, I love it. All right, let's go to some of the calls. We have a lot of people who have ghost tales to share as well. Paul is on the line from Barnard. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
Really enjoying your show.
Tell us your story.
The story happened on Glastonbury when I was hiking on Glastonbury. It was in early April. There was fresh snow on the ground. And I was about to take the trail up the mountain off Route 9 there, near Bennington, and the long trail had been relocated from there. So my old guidebook had the old trail on it, and I decided it would be an adventure to take this old, unused trail, even though the blazes had been painted over. I thought that added to the adventure. So I started my hike. I got about 4 miles in, and it started to get dark. So I bushwhacked about 30 miles off the trail in the flat area, to set up my tent. Even though I wasn't even on the used trail, I still thought it would be best if I didn't hike right, you know, camp right on the trail. So I went about 30 yards off the trail in this fresh snow. I set up my tent, had my dinner, got dark, got into my sleeping bag, and was ready to go to sleep. Suddenly, I heard footsteps coming right towards the tent, and they were definitely human footsteps. I could tell it wasn't a four-legged gait. It was definitely two-legged person coming towards the tent. Kept coming closer and closer. It stopped about 3 feet from the tent and just stopped. And I could feel the presence. I could feel it right there. And I could hear my heart beating, and I was too terrified to get out of the tent at that point. So I just sat there and waited. I eventually, just through exhaustion, fell asleep. And then the next morning I got up and went out, and I looked, and there was only one set of tracks coming in. It was my set coming in, and there weren't any tracks where I heard the footsteps.
Oh. Nice.
And that's my ghost story.
Oh, I love it. Thank you for sharing that. It's, you know, I'm loving all of the hair that rises on my arms while you're telling these stories. It's really wonderful. Let's hear another one here from Monica in Montpelier. Hi, Monica. What's your story?
Well, it's a story about a restaurant that's, in the 21 years I've lived in Montpelier, been under three different names. And so when I first was here, it was Julio's. And Julio's moved from this location that occupied the second and third floor to, to a different street, so from Main to State Street. And when there was nothing left to take with the real estate sale of the business except for the remnants of Marco the Magician, who has this little thing that he does at restaurants, and he goes to tables, he asks you, what's your card? He pulls it out. He always gets the card that you chose. And there was a friend, George, who often took me and my daughters and put the initials of the people at the table and the date, and then he would just flick it with his forefinger and would stay on the ceiling. And he's done these events throughout the state. But the night that this gentleman, George's nephew, who was the bartender, looked up and said, well, the only thing left is Marco's cards. And he got up, it was like 2 in the morning, and he climbed the ladder and he reached for one card. And they all fell down at once.
Ooh.
And he ran away from the building and never wanted to talk about it. And so that story goes back at least 15 years. But since then, I'd heard so many stories about, you know, that location being haunted. And so then it became the Black Door. And after it was the Black Door, it became La Puerta Negra. And it was when La Puerta Negra just recently opened, and it was just a few days ahead of Halloween. I went with a very sensible young coworker of mine, and we were seated at the bar. And I was the L-shaped bar, and so we were on the short end, the only two people. And facing out, I could see this little table that sat in front of a window before you go up to the third floor, and two young women there. And, you know, I glanced casually over the time that we were there, and then all of a sudden, there was this moment when the tablecloth, which was put on crosswise so that the points of the tablecloth are opposite the points of the table, the tablecloth just got tugged. And a few of their small plates and a candle went to the floor. And the candle was in one of those rounded bottomed, you know, little like wine glasses. And when it fell to the floor, the warm wax actually coated the side of the candle holder, and the bartender walked out. He righted things, and the women said nothing to him. I watched the whole thing. He came back behind the bar. He said, you saw that, didn't you? I said, yeah, I did. And the women shortly left after that. I can tell they were just like, yeah, we're just going to exit very gracefully and not say anything.
Oh, Monica, and I love the stories. I love hearing about that. And especially more than one occasion and sort of and more than one witness there with you and everybody else getting creeped out. And Monica, who's still willing to go and experience this. I love it. Tim Simard, when you hear about people who have experiences like this and one unexplained experience, fine. Two, you start to think, all right, this is a place maybe I don't want to go back. For you with the haunted hikes, I mean, are these places that people keep coming back to? Is there something compelling about returning to the place where you've had an unexplained experience?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, Glastonbury is a perfect example of that. I mean, that's a popular hiking place for southern Vermont, so people are always returning there. But I kind of wanted to go back to what the caller said from Barnard. He went up the old Long Trail, which is off Harbor Road in Woodford, and the further you go up that trail, which is relatively easy to follow still, there's an old ghost town up there where they used to have logging camps. I mean, they'd have hotels, casinos, like illegal casinos, but there were a lot of people up there in these logging camps. And in that area where he had that experience, there was an actual murder that took place. Several people have actually disappeared in that valley, that little notch there, right where he camped out. So who knows what whose footsteps he was hearing. So when he was saying all that, I was like, oh, he was right in the spot.
Oh, I wonder if he knew.
He probably didn't.
Let's get another call in here from Glennie Sewell. Not exactly a call. Actually, Glennie's in our studio. Glennie's a professor of English at Norwich University. Hi, Professor Sewell. Thanks for joining us.
I really appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
We were talking earlier about how schools, colleges, universities seem very popular places for hauntings. Norwich University itself is a place that has some ghosts, and you can talk about them. How many ghosts, and what are you experiencing?
I'll certainly be coming from my own experience, and there's plenty of well documented rumor and story that comes from Norwich about ghosts that are there. But there are also plenty of experiences from the students, be it cadets or civilian students, faculty, staff, many stories. But my experience starts from when I first started working there last year in 2016 and was doing an investigation of Sullivan Museum and was going into the basement of Sullivan Museum. And on one of my digital recordings of a person who was not with me, only one other person was with me in the stairwell, the person who was working for the museum, and a person in the stairwell called me out by name.
Whoa.
and said that I was there. And I'm like, okay, how do they know me like that? I just started here, and I just got to do this investigation, and I'm teaching English. So also, because it's a museum, many of the artifacts have attachments. And they're in the basement, myself and another student who was assisting me in the investigation, we did separate recordings and walked away from each other. And the other people who were in the basement with us, you can't really hear them. They would have to yell for you to hear them. So you can't hear them. They're off doing their museum duties. But my student asks someone if the helmet he was staring at, if that was his. And he hears in the background someone go, no. And very clearly, very class A EVP go, no. Answering the questions for him and walking around. And we caught children on our recorders. We caught children laughing and playing on the recorders, on the digital recorders we were using. In the museum, I mean, there's a lot of in and out activity, and a lot of the feeling of being surrounded. Now, there's no danger in such a case. It's just there's a lot of activity around you. It's a very thick location.
Now, you said you just started. When you started and you were applying for the job at Norwich University, and you said, and I will be doing paranormal investigations and I'll be teaching paranormal literature. You don't necessarily think of that happening at a military academy. So did you reveal it?
I don't teach paranormal literature, though. I teach English lit. I teach English comp, excuse me. I teach writing. So I don't really teach paranormal literature. I only do that on the side for no money. I do it for my paranormal organization. I have a paranormal organization that I have, Messenger Guardians Paranormal, out of Montpelier. So I do it for them, and I do it for that. And I do it at other locations. But no, I just happened to be a paranormal investigator when I came on, and I let that be known. It just so happens. And they wanted me to do something with that. So there's issues on campus, for instance, with Alumni Hall. And there's a rather long-lived dark presence in Alumni Hall, which there are students who were related to each other as brothers that hung themselves there decades and decades ago, back in the previous century, I believe, in 19th or 20th century. So there's issues there. Students have come to me about issues in Goodyear Hall. They've come to me with their. I did a recording outside of Darmable Hall, and had someone speaking. I even had myself and another student who was helping me, even had a person's finger, a ring, appear in front of us on the sidewalk. And when it wasn't there when we were there doing recordings, and no one walked between us. It was just suddenly there, a gold ring, an old, old ring, the kind that's kind of painted gold practically, but it's old. And it was really interesting when that happened. And that was just a few, that was several weeks ago during an investigation, which I don't often publicize when I'm doing them and how I'm doing them, but there's a lot of activity. Here's one thing about hauntings. There's one thing about places that have lots of spirit energies, whether they're earthbound spirits, whether they're whether you think they're angelic or guardian or what have or dark, what have you, is that the more people there are in a location, the more physical, corporeal humans or anybody, any life, corporeal life in a physical location, the more of them there are because they feed on that energy and they are attracted to because we're all made of the same energy. So the more if we're gathered in a large location like a graduation or a dance, they're there probably in the hundreds, sometimes tens or hundreds. So they're standing along the back wall or up along the watching from a corner or standing within the crowd. They're there in great numbers.
Well, so there you have it. So don't go to the cemeteries. Go to the places where the crowds are, that the spirits are drawn to them. Boy, I could listen to your stories, Glennie, and our other guests' stories all day, but I'm afraid we don't have any more time, but this has been wonderful. Glennie Sewell is a professor of English at Norwich University and a paranormal investigator. Thank you so much, Professor Sewell. Thea Lewis is the creator of Queen City Ghost Walk and the author of Haunted Burlington and Ghosts and Legends of Lake Champlain. I know you're still here. Thanks, Thea.
I'm still here. Thanks for having me.
Tim Simard is the author of Haunted Hikes of Vermont, and we'll put links to information up on all of our guests today at vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition, and please continue to share your ghost stories. We had some wonderful stories of people who wanted to share on the phone, and I'm sorry we didn't get to you, but I really, really want to hear your stories, so please go to vpr.net and share them on the Vermont Edition page. Thanks very much to you, Tim, as well.